Hello, everyone. This is Brian Smith with the Sioux Empire Commercial Real Estate Podcast. This is episode 2, and I have Alex Hallback with Cutler Law Firm again on this second episode. The first episode, we spoke about major provisions of a lease, whether it be rent, triple nets, and uses of a property, and all the details that go along with that. So if you have interest in those topics, you can go back to episode 1 and take a look at that. And today we're going to be digging into a little more of the detailed items in a lease and some of the things that are maybe a little more obscure that you may not be as familiar with, and have Alex give us his expertise and help us understand all of those details as well. So thanks for being on the podcast with me again, Alex.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So where should we start?
Well, I think, you know, last time we talked about a lot of the more general provisions, base rent, escalation clauses, and some of those, what I would call more foundational elements of the commercial lease. I think one of the areas that you and I had talked about briefly last time around that we thought maybe we should take a deeper dive into is the indemnification clause or indemnification provisions of a lease. So I think that's maybe a decent place to start. It's one of those provisions where I think both tenants and landlords don't always necessarily understand what it means, what's included, what's not included. And so that's maybe a place where we can take a look at it. I mean, I know we've got a lease here in front of us. Oftentimes, though, when I think of indemnification, I think of it as being a provision that says, if I do something wrong as the tenant and somebody sues you as the landlord for the wrongful acts of me as the tenant is going to make sure that you as the landlord aren't responsible for those bad acts. Okay. And the way that, you know, comes across, it can be in any number of areas or places. For instance, if you're the landlord and you are leasing to me, let's just say, maybe it's a glass shop. Okay. I do repairs for stained glass or something like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, I create this beautiful glass chandelier, but I use subpar joints, or I use a foreign glass that is more prone to shattering or something, and someone trips in the parking lot and this glass shatters into a million pieces and they stab themselves and die in the parking lot. Yep. When the family sues you, the landlord, because their loved one died in the parking lot because the tenant used subpar glass and overly fragile glass or whatever, the tenant essentially says, I'll make sure, landlord, that you aren't responsible for any of those acts.
Sure.
Okay. So that's indemnification. Tenant agrees to indemnify landlord for those acts.
Well, and people may be asking, well, why would someone sue the landlord in that situation? But you know far better.
Because lawyers sue everybody.
Yeah. Well, that's one item. But the other thing too is, you know, in general, you go after who has more money.
Well, you generally go after, at least to begin with, you know, you would look at the tenant might be responsible, but there might be landlord culpability. The landlord might know that this has happened. They might be aware that the tenant is doing this. They might have some other, you know, some other cause of action, or at least related cause of action. So as a lawyer representing the family, I'm going to say I'm going to sue landlord and tenant until we figure out who's actually responsible. Mm-hmm. Okay. A lot of times these indemnification provisions, again, include, like, if you're the landlord in our scenario and you go out to hire an attorney to help, you know, defend that lawsuit that's filed against you, a lot of times tenant is responsible for those attorney's fees.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, ultimately the lawsuit's probably going to be dismissed against the landlord, but it doesn't mean you're not going to have to at least start with, get some defense and spend some dollars,
right,
to show that you weren't responsible. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that would be covered under most, what I would say, standard indemnification provisions. Now, you and I have also seen provisions in leases, though, where landlord says, I'm not going to indemnify tenant at all for anything. And one of the things that we also generally see is an indemnification for the tenant from landlord if the landlord is negligent or grossly negligent in your responsibilities as a landlord. If you're in a multi-tenant building and, you know, you've got sidewalks that are falling into a sinkhole and you decide that you're just going to put duct tape over the seams of the concrete and somebody walks over it and they fall in, you should be responsible for that, right?
That's exactly right.
So that's where, you know, and again, these are, people might think these are funny examples, but I mean, not that they're sinkholes that usually happen in commercial properties, but these types of scenarios do come up on occasion where a landlord knew that there was something wrong, didn't maintain it, or was negligent in their maintenance to a level that was so extreme that they knew or should have known that somebody was going to get injured or hurt based mm-hmm. upon their maintenance, which then exposes them to liability.
The key to every provision in a lease is the reason it's in there is because it's come up in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, that these things weren't just thought up for no reason. It's they're addressing issues that have come up in prior situations.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's just really important to review with your attorney, you know, what is my exposure? What am I responsible for? And how is that triggered? Again, is it gross negligence? Is it slight negligence? I mean, to what extent, you know, if a landlord doesn't replace a sidewalk that is dropped a quarter of an inch and somebody trips and hits their head and dies on the sidewalk, is that landlord's problem because it was dropped a quarter inch? Is that negligence or is it gross negligence? I mean, where does that fall? So understanding what's included in those indemnification provisions, both from a landlord perspective and a tenant perspective, is important.
Well, and another point I think that's really important, I know, you know, attorneys and time with your attorney can feel like it's expensive. But if you don't understand the provisions of the lease that you're signing, I mean, yeah, I suppose what you could do is have your attorney review the lease and say, okay, are we good to go or are we not good to go? Mm-hmm. But I think spending a little extra time and having your attorney actually explain the different provisions in detail on any questions that you have and things you don't understand, I think that's time well spent, regardless of what they charge. Boy, now that's a big statement.
Oh, yeah.
That opens the door for you,
Alex. Keep that in mind. No. It's one of those, you know, I always tell people you can pay a little bit up front and make sure you're covered and know what's happening, or potentially you run the risk of, you know, hiring an attorney at the back end to defend and yeah. it being a lot more expensive. It's way cheaper to paper something right on the front end than it is to sue it out and deal with it on the backside.
Exactly.
From an attorney's perspective.
That's so, right.
Well, I mean, that's, again, that's the nuts and bolts of some of the indemnification language. Again, you know, I would expect in a normal situation that there be some mutuality. There's some indemnification of both landlord and tenant in what I would call a reasonable lease.
Right.
If it's super one-sided, if tenant is only indemnifying landlord for any and everything, period, irrespective of what happens, I would say that might be a deal killer, depending on how much the tenant wants the space. So
and it actually was a deal killer for us on mm-hmm. one. And the problem is, you know, if everything goes smoothly and there's never an issue, then you're fine. It's not a big deal. But yeah, if you do have some kind of a major problem, you know, arise, it can cost tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to remedy.
And it might not even be a major thing. It might even be a minor thing, depending on how the indemnification clause is written. Mm-hmm. I mean, any minor infraction, even by tenant, if the indemnification clause is written so broadly, you would potentially be on the hook for that as well. So again, that's why read those provisions super carefully, understand the landlord indemnification provisions, understand what tenant is going to indemnify landlord for, and then try to find, again, you know, there's the art of the deal, right? There's always a crossover somewhere where it makes sense that shared mutuality of risk makes sense to proceed forward with the transaction.
Yeah, so, in the vast majority of cases, that's correct.
Yeah, and again, I would say from Sioux Falls' perspective, most of the commercial leases that I review are pretty good as far as they're pretty fair. Mm-hmm. You don't see leases all that often that are so one-sided one way or the other because people around here aren't going to do deals that way.
Yeah.
They all, I think in Sioux Falls and in this area, just in general, people are generally reasonable, mm-hmm. especially if they've been in business for any amount of time.
That's right. And, so, you know, to an extent, I mean, as a landlord, I take the lead of my my attorney in those situations. Mm-hmm. And so I think the attorneys here in town in general, you know, understand what's fair and what's reasonable and what's normal practices or normal language in a lease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you would put, you know, some radical language into a lease and an attorney from another firm would take a look at it, he'd probably give you a call and say, Alex, seriously? Yeah. You know, I mean, I think there are normal provisions that people are expect and find mutually acceptable.
I mean, once in a while you run into an attorney from like Arizona who doesn't understand the way South Dakota is, yeah. and then it gets to be problems. But that's a whole nother kind of, it's a whole nother, probably another podcast.
Yeah, episode. That's exactly right.
We've killed a couple deals, haven't we?
but we've protected people in the process. Yes, so, yeah.
Right. But sometimes deals should die.
That's right.
But okay, so that's one of the provisions I think is kind of important. Let's talk about a little bit about assignment and subletting too. Mm-hmm. This is something that I see misconceptions with tenants quite a bit, especially inexperienced tenants that come in, they rent a property. Maybe they decide, hey, I don't need all the space, or ultimately maybe their business doesn't work mm-hmm. and they need to find, they'd say, hey, well, I found somebody that's willing to take over the space. You know, this is great. I'm just going to wash my hands of this. And now you can deal with that new person. And that's not necessarily the way this works, right? If I'm representing tenant and I'm looking at that assignment and subletting paragraph, oftentimes the paragraph allows, or the provisions generally allow for assignment and subletting with the consent of landlord, first mm-hmm. of all. I always like to include language such that, and that the consent shall not be unreasonably withheld. Meaning that if your business is an office tenant and you decide, hey, this space isn't working, maybe you outgrow it, right?
Right.
Maybe you need a bigger space and this isn't working for you. And you find another office tenant that comes in that's willing to pay the same amount, that does approximately the same thing, landlord shouldn't be able to say no to that just for the sake of saying no.
Exactly.
Right? So, unreasonable consent to, is a kind of a tag-along provision that I always see. You know, the lease may be assigned with the consent of landlord, which consent shall not be unreasonably withheld.
Right.
Okay? But a lot of times a common misconception is that as a tenant who assigns that lease to a subtenant or to a third party, they believe that they're absolved of all responsibility under the lease. And that isn't exactly the way that goes.
Right.
Oftentimes that original tenant essentially stays on as almost a third party to fill in if the obligations of that new subtenant aren't fulfilled, meaning that, okay, so I outgrow an office space and I bring in, you know, Joe Schmo third party to come in. They are going to be the subtenant for landlord.
Yep.
And they, for whatever reason, default on that monthly payment obligation.
Right.
Well, I'm going to go back to that original tenant and say, well, your subtenant didn't fulfill their obligations. So tenant, now you're on the hook for it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people are like, well, wait a minute. You have a subtenant now. You don't need me. That's done. Well, it's really not done. So, and a lot of times when I draft those, I'm including a consent or an acknowledgement by the tenant that their responsibilities are ongoing if there's a failure by the subtenant.
Well, and so, unless we talked about this before too, unless a landlord literally absolves a tenant of their responsibilities, lets them totally out of the lease, you know, and takes on a new tenant, that original tenant is on the hook.
Yep.
You know, and so that's part of the reason why, I mean, subleases, it seems like it's harder to fill subleases for one reason or another. And part of the reason is because the water can get so muddy
yeah.
when you've got multiple tenants. And what happens if the subtenant does damage to the property, and who's going to be held responsible for those things. Right. And you've got multiple parties as a landlord to try to, collect from and that kind of thing.
A lot of times if I'm representing a landlord and a tenant is requesting that, the only way that I will is requesting a release of their obligations. Generally speaking, the only way that I advise that's a smart decision is if the guarantor, the guarantor of the subtenant is stronger than the guarantor of the first tenant. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you're trading in a Buick and getting a Cadillac or a Mercedes on the backside, right for a guarantor, mm-hmm. then I'll usually say, hey, this might be an okay deal because you're getting more collateral, mm-hmm. right, in the new deal,
right.
such that it's okay to release the other guy. He might not be able to pay anyway if something happens. So take a stronger guarantor, release the original tenant. Now there's just that one-way relationship. But then usually what I do is I don't do an assignment. I do a new lease.
Right.
I terminate the original lease, enter into a new lease with the subtenant and go about it that way.
I got a question for you on that. Let's say that you've got a sublease tenant who wants to see some remodeling done.
Siri thought that was a great question to ask.
Boy, I tell you what, when Siri tells you that you're asking a good question,
she's listening.
Yep, all the time.
Sometimes even when you don't want her to be.
Right. So, what if a sublease tenant wants to remodel the space?
Yep.
So how does that work?
Mm-hmm. So usually, again, if you have, let's say that you've put in leasehold improvements for the first tenant, mm-hmm. and you've put in X number of dollars for a 5-year lease term,
right?
Then the subtenant comes along and wants tenant improvement dollars too,
right?
To remodel the space. Then I usually look at, there's an unamortized portion or an undepreciated portion of that build out, right? So let's say you put $10,000 in for a 5-year. That's essentially $2,000 a year is what you paid for that. Well, I take that $2,000 and I either ask the tenant to reimburse me for mm-hmm. that last year, right? That's fine. I'll terminate your lease, but I need $2,000 back. And then I go negotiate a new deal with the new subtenant for maybe he wanted to originally take over for a year. Well, I'm going to go to him and say, I'm going to take the $2,000 that I got back from tenant number one. I'm going to throw another $10,000 at it, but I want you to sign a 6-year lease.
Sure.
Yep. And so you execute a new lease and extend out the term.
That makes sense.
Add new escalators, go through the full process with the new tenant. Mm-hmm. And really, from a landlord's perspective, that's a good deal.
Absolutely.
Because now I got somebody on the hook for another 5 years versus having exposure after 1 year.
That's exactly right.
So that's the way I would recommend to do it. Now, some might say, well, I don't want to pay the $2,000 back. And then it's just a business decision, right? Well, if I can get another 5-year tenant, do I give up $2,000 today to get mm-hmm. 5 years of rental income at whatever the cap rate might be?
Right.
It might make sense. So it's a business decision at that point.
Exactly. And there again, everything's negotiable. Mm-hmm. So
that's, again, understanding the assignment and subletting provisions of that lease is really important when you're trying to figure out how might this impact me if something goes wrong, mm-hmm. if I'm the tenant, right? And from the landlord's perspective, you just want to know who's operating in your space. And you want reasonable assurances that you're going to get your rent payment every month.
Right. And so let's really quickly go over some reasons why a landlord may say no to mm-hmm. a sublease tenant.
Sure. So if it's a change in use, right? If you're going from an office and now all of a sudden the new tenant wants to cut a hole in the wall and use it as a garage,
mm-hmm.
you might say no, right? And a court's going to view that as that's not unreasonably withholding, right? If you're changing the use paragraph of that lease,
yep,
that might be it. You know, if you're going from maybe it's a, maybe if it's in a strip mall that's zoned like commercial or something that allows for office use, and now it's a coffee shop that wants to go in, and again, they're going to have to modify the building, add a drive-up lane.
Yep.
Maybe they're untested in the market. Maybe it's a new concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's risk there on the landlord side. Again, try to find another tenant. I'm not comfortable with that one.
Right.
That might be the response. So.
Well, and one other thing that pops into my mind too, let's say it is an office use in a multi-tenant building. And let's say the current tenant is an insurance agent and the sublease tenant is a chiropractor and you already have a chiropractor in that building. And a lot of times almost all the time, the lease with your original chiropractor tenant has a provision in it that you
doesn't
can't
allow for another one.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can't allow a competing business in the same building. Yeah.
That's an easy one. I mean, that's an easy, no, I can't consent to that because there's contractual provisions that I've entered into that prohibit me from doing that.
Exactly.
So, I mean, those are some of the reasons why I generally see a landlord say, not comfortable with this assignment or subletting. Or alternatively, also, I mean, if tenant comes in or subtenant is some, again, somebody that's not tried in the market, a new concept maybe with a really no guarantor or a weak guarantor, mm-hmm. and you're going to let this go in with a risky concept to take over, in that situation, I would never let the original tenant out of there. Obligations.
Right.
It would not be a full release. I would hold on to the original tenant. Mm-hmm. And if they want to risk their butt on the line because they think their subtenant is going to be able to fulfill the rental obligations, well, then you're kind of, they're kind of sharing in that liability exposure.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, so I guess those are some of the reasons why an assignment might not take place. But more often than not, again, in Sioux Falls, if it's a reasonable use, it's comparable or similar to what the use was previously, more often than not, I see those assignments granted,
mm-hmm.
you know? So again, but you got to understand what's in there when you get
right.
into it, right?
Exactly.
What does it include? What happens if I don't, if there's a default, what happens if, you know, ultimately I need to leave and what does that consent look like? So perfect. Another provision I think we wanted to maybe just touch on today, and it's kind of an interesting one based on, you know, what's been happening with COVID and this lovely pandemic that we've been living in for the last 18 months is the use of a force majeure clause to void or to absolve a tenant of their obligations under the lease. Mm-hmm. This is something that we've been seeing a little bit kind of scattered across the country. I don't know that there have been any direct cases on point in South Dakota, but generally speaking, a force majeure clause allows for a tenant to not pay their or not perform their obligations under the lease because of really, it's generally acts of God or something that's outside of their control or is really not foreseen. A lot of times what we always learn about this, these provisions in law school is essentially you own a grocery store. I think of like St. Peter, Minnesota, and a tornado comes through and hits your store.
Right.
You shouldn't have to keep paying rent if the building is really not there anymore or gets hit by something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Floods, you know, major weather events, you know, windstorm that knocks out power or something like that.
Right.
But what we've seen is people using those provisions to essentially avoid paying rent because of COVID, government mm-hmm. shutdowns and things like that. And these paragraphs have always kind of had language in there that was maybe a little gray on
sure.
making that argument. And now what we're starting to see is more and more landlords include specific exclusions for pandemics or disease issues in that clause, and tenants trying to broaden that language to include closures because of government, government acts or just disease in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be the flu. Right. I mean, somebody could take it as broadly as saying, well, all my staff got flu and we had to close. So I'm not paying rent during that period.
Sure.
And that's the fear is that this gets, well, I've got a common cold. I couldn't come into work. So I'm not paying rent today.
Right. Yeah.
But like this provision, for instance, talks about whenever a period of time is herein provided for either party to do or perform any act or thing, and included in that would be the payment of rent. The party shall not be liable or responsible for any delays in applicable periods for performance shall be extended. due to strikes, lockouts, riots, acts of God, shortages of labor or materials, national emergency, acts of a public enemy, government restrictions, laws or regulations, or any other cause or causes, whether similar or dissimilar, beyond its reasonable control, right? So, you know, again, on the government restrictions, you know, Sioux Falls somewhat experienced this. Other, you know, Brookings actually had more of a mandated shutdown. Mm-hmm. You know, Sioux Falls required masking. Some businesses said, well, you know, I can't operate with masks, so we're going to shut down, you know, and that government restrictions could be a potentially an area where a tenant could say, hey, because of this, I'm not paying rent.
Right.
Right. So these clauses are in what I like to call the boilerplate sections of the contract. They're usually in all the crap at the end that nobody really reads.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Just, I mean, I'll just throw it out there. Right. You get, oh, well, recordance, acceptance of payment, unenforceability, governing laws, waiver, execution of lease, rights to repair, rights to inspect, it's all that stuff. You're like, and then there's everything else.
Right.
Well, this paragraph, nobody really paid attention to because it was never really triggered.
Right.
How often does a tornado wipe out your property? Not very often.
Right. Exactly. Hopefully. Yeah. Or a riot.
Yeah. Or a riot. You know,
which actually come up in the last year or so.
That's
here.
Been something in Minneapolis that we saw during. And so
on that subject. So obviously, if there are multi-day riots and things are shut down for weeks, whatever that may be, obviously businesses can't operate in those kind of conditions. But what if the riots damage the building that the business is trying to operate out of? Does mm-hmm. that come under the force majeure clause as well?
So force majeure, again, let's say for instance, the windows are all broken out and mm-hmm. you've got a board up, right? Well, that would be potentially riot that caused the closure. So that would abate rent. But then you would look to the insurance provisions to see who's responsible
right.
for payment of replacing that plate glass and things like that. And we talked about those insurance provisions last time, but you know, depending on how the insurance provisions in the lease are written, depending on how the policies are written, both from the landlord's perspective and the tenant's perspective, there's probably going to be a bit of an insurance battle
right.
to figure out whose policies cover, if the policies cover at all. And if the policies don't come into play, then what does the lease say as far as whose responsibility it is to replace that plate glass?
Yeah.
Might be tenants, might be landlords. So.
And the interesting part about that, especially when insurance is involved, usually the landlord and the tenant don't care which insurance company pays as long as an insurance company pays, because mm-hmm. that's the reason you buy insurance.
Yep. So it's an interesting provision, and one, you know, that a tenant and also a landlord should be aware of what their force majeure includes. It's mm-hmm. usually pretty all encompassing. Because it usually doesn't get triggered very often.
Right.
But again, with riots, with just the state of where the world is right now, this provision is all of a sudden becoming more and more important. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing a multi-million dollar deal here, I would pay close attention to what's allowed. I mean, even a small deal. I mean, every dollar counts, obviously. But,
right.
you know, pay attention to what's included in that, what's allowed, what it does. Sometimes I've seen them also where it might delay for the closure, right? So let's say that it knocks that plate glass out and you're down for 2 months. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some force majeure provisions that tack that 2 months onto the end of the lease and extends the lease by the period of time for the closure.
Sure.
So we've seen all sorts of creative things out there too. You know, from a landlord's perspective, if I got to wait 60 days to get my rental payments, but that means I get 60 more days of rent on the backside of the lease, mm-hmm. I'm probably going to be okay with that.
Sure.
Right. So it's interesting stuff to look into. And there's some cases kind of all over the country that have dug into those and whether that is included or excluded as part of that. So.
Well, and that's the other interesting thing about any legal document. You know, just because a certain understanding was intended in the way it was written doesn't mean it's interpreted that way when it gets in front of a court or a judge. I mean, those things can be.
And you know what we hear all the time is we're like, that's not what we meant that to say.
Yeah, right, right.
So that isn't what that actually means. Oh, really? Well, let's talk about what it actually means.
Then. Well, maybe you should have been a little bit more careful about how you worded that then.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, like those three provisions, you know, we just spent 30 minutes, you know, chatting about those. But those are, again, three important provisions that I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand as they walk through it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every provision is important for various reasons. But those are some ones that, you know, again, indemnification, people don't even think about what that means and they skip over it. So,
right.
You know, pay attention to that. Be careful with it, especially depending on what your long-term plans are for the space. So,
well, and another thing that I want to bring up and talk about just a little bit, and this is just going off of the memory that I have of negotiating my first lease with my first tenant. I worked with the person that I was going to be leasing space to, which was a really unique situation. He was my supervisor and I was going to be his landlord. And so that caused going through the first reading of the lease for him really caused some stress on the relationship.
Yeah.
Because he was taking things that were in the lease very personally, mm-hmm. that I potentially didn't even know were in there. I just passed the lease on from my attorney to yep. him. And he was saying, well, why is there a provision in here that I can't get up on the roof? Well, because I'm guessing because it was in the template that yep. my attorney, you know, has for their lease document. And, you know, if a tenant is allowed to get on the roof and falls off, then guess who's going to be responsible yeah. and liable for that?
Well, what do you want to get on the roof for?
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting in that situation. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, especially if someone has not leased space very often, or this is the first lease document that they're reading through, they can get upset and it can cause a negative working relationship with
sure.
their landlord. And the landlord may not intend to be restrictive in any way.
Yeah.
It just, you know, could be verbiage that their attorney normally uses in a normal lease and, mm-hmm. and the tenant is not familiar with it or understands that's
a standard provision.
Exactly.
Yep.
So, and really in my mind, part of my job as a commercial real estate agent isn't just to get a deal done. It's also to try to help facilitate a good working relationship with tenant and landlord,
mm-hmm.
because that's an ongoing relationship. If you've got a purchase of a property and you get people that are upset with each other, you know, through that purchase negotiation, well, they don't have to continue to work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one deal and then they're done. And maybe they have another transaction at some point down the road. Maybe they never talk to each other again.
Yeah, right.
But when you've got a landlord and a tenant who are going to have an ongoing working relationship, in my mind, it's pretty important for both sides to understand that, you know, we're not trying to hurt each other here.
Yeah.
You know, we're just trying to come to an agreement that protects both sides, that is fair for both sides, and can facilitate a good working relationship. Because the thing a tenant needs to understand is most landlords want their tenants to stay a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is ideal to
and
have
to not do any improvements to them.
Well, if the tenant's willing to pay for some of those improvements,
yeah.
then that's not so bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the thing. A landlord is not trying to, you know, be insulting toward a tenant or to damage the tenant's ability to operate or run their business. They're not trying to be restrictive. They're just trying to protect themselves.
Right. That's a great point. Thank you so much for having me on again this time. This was fun. I'm sure not everybody is going to find discussing indemnification provisions fun, but this was a good conversation and hopefully we can dive into some other topics at some point in the future.
That sounds great. Thanks so much for being on, Alex.
Thank you.